Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Today we'll be looking at Sutta number 107 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Ganika Moggallana Sutta, a sutta on the gradual training. And this is quite a straightforward sutta, which contains one of the most famous and often repeated similes given by the Buddha for the gradual training towards enlightenment, as being like someone setting out on a journey. And this sutta which we're doing today is one that I've chosen particularly because it is quite straightforward and it doesn't require too much mental activity in this hot weather. And actually I had another sutta picked out for today, but it just requires too much explanation and is too involved. So I'll try and tackle that one next time I'm down, and that will leave for another day. So if you've seen this sutta before and studied this one, I apologise to you for the fact that we'll be repeating something, but it's a very clear outline of the path necessary to follow and to be practiced if we want to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So we'll start with reading through. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in the eastern park in the palace of Migara's mother. And this is the second most famous monastery in the biggest city of the day, Sarvati. And Migara's mother is Visakha, who was the foremost female lay disciple of the Buddha in terms of her benevolence and generosity. And she built this monastery after the Buddha came to stay at the Jetavana, Anathapindika's monastery, which was also in Sarvati. And she's called Migara's mother. Migara was her father-in-law, and because of Visakha's influence, Migara became a disciple of the Buddha, and so he always referred to his daughter-in-law as his mother, because she was his mother in the Dharma, bringing him to become a follower of the Buddha. So we're at the eastern park in the palace of Migara's mother. Then the Brahmin Ganika Moggallana went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One. Now Ganika Moggallana means the accountant Moggallana. So this is one of the prominent lay people from the town, from the city of Sarvati, which was the most prosperous city of India at that time. So he's come to speak with the Buddha. Master Gotama, in this palace of Migara's mother, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress, that is, down to the last step of the staircase. Now just notice that there is gradual training, that is the outline, the blueprint of what needs to be done. And then there's gradual practice, that is actually doing it, putting a theory into practice. And the gradual progress is the result of putting the theory into practice. And this gradual training is so well set out that it's down to the last step of the staircase. Among these Brahmins too, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice and gradual progress, that is, in study. So for the Brahmins, the most important part of their training and their practice was to study the ancient scriptures, the Vedas, and then to become familiar with them and to be able to perform the ceremonies and rituals that went along with the practices outlined in the Vedas. So among the Brahmins, there's also this gradual training, this gradual practice, and this gradual progress that is in study. Among archers too, there can be seen gradual training in archery, and also among accountants like us, who earn our living by accountancy, there can be seen gradual training, that is, in computation. For when we get an apprentice, first we make him count 1 1, 2 2s, 3 3s, 4 4s, 5 5s, 6 6s, 7 7s, 8 8s, 9 9s, 10 10s. He has to learn his tables if he's going to be an accountant. And we make him count 100 too. Now, is it also possible, Master Gotama, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dharma and discipline? And this is the Buddha speaking now in response to that inquiry. It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dharma and discipline. Just as Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterwards trains him further. And I'll just refer to the image which the Buddha is setting up of this gradual training. In Sutta number 65, the Badali Sutta, the Buddha talks about what is the process of training a fine thoroughbred colt. Badali, suppose a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt. He first makes him get used to wearing the bit. While the colt is being made to get used to wearing the bit, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in that action. When the colt has become peaceful in that action, the horse trainer further makes him get used to wearing the harness. While the colt is being made to get used to wearing the harness, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in that action. When the colt has become peaceful in that action, the horse trainer further makes him act in keeping in step, in running in circle, in prancing, in galloping, in charging, and in the kingly qualities, in the kingly heritage, in the highest speed, in the highest fleetness, and in the highest gentleness. While the colt is being made to get used to doing these things, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in those actions. When the colt has become peaceful in these actions, the horse trainer further rewards him with a rubbing down and a grooming. When a fine thoroughbred colt possesses these 10 factors, he is worthy of the king, in the king's service, and considered one of the factors of a king. So the Buddha is just describing how a thoroughbred colt has to go through this process of training, a gradual training, and in that process, because he's learning and being forced to do things that he's not been used to, initially there is this writhing and contortion, and this is what it's like to take up the gradual training in this Dharma and discipline that because the training involves doing something with the mind and with the speech and also with behavior that is new and which one is not used to, it can follow that there is initially some resistance, some contortion, some writhing, trying to wriggle out of the training that's necessary. So from the Buddha saying, just as Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterwards trains him further. So when the Tathagata obtains a person to be tamed, he first disciplines him thus. Come, bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha. Be perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. So, though the Buddha is referring here to a bhikkhu, who is a monk or a nun who's taken up the homeless life, this really refers to anyone who's taking up this spiritual path. The first step on the path is to undertake the discipline necessary, whether it is the 5 precepts or the 10 precepts, the 8 precepts, or taking up the full training which the bhikkhus follow, 227 precepts. Whatever standard that you've taken upon yourself to train in those precepts, so that you become perfect in them, perfect in conduct and perfect in resort. And this conduct refers to both the restraint that comes with taking on these voluntary precepts or restrictions, but also in using those precepts to reflect on one's experience and to observe the writhing and the contortions that take place as we try to live within the guidelines of the precepts. So remembering that with the image of the thoroughbred colt taking up the training, and because it's something that the horse isn't used to, doesn't take it on easily. There is some resistance and some fighting, some obstacles to being at peace with wearing the bit and being comfortable with wearing the bit. And so when we start to take up these precepts and try to introduce them into our daily life, we find that there are challenges in doing that. Some of the precepts we may find quite easy to keep, or we might readily understand the value of them in our life. And other precepts we may think, well, they're not really important, those ones. It doesn't matter whether I keep them or not. Some precepts we might find we can keep at certain times, but other times we find it's a real challenge. And in this regard, when we look at the way that the Buddha explains it, he says, to be restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, the rules of conduct, to be perfect in conduct and resort. And this refers to the practice, especially for monastics, of refraining from going to those places where one is going to be tempted to break the precepts. So there are certain situations that are expressly forbidden for monastics to go to, such as places of entertainment, to watch army parades or go to army camps where there's parades and exercises being held, Going to the cinema would be an example of wrong resort now. Going to a nightclub, for example, a dance party on the foreshore or whatever. But if we reflect on this, not just for monastics, but for lay people, you know that you, once you start to observe the precepts, that very often it means that you are no longer comfortable in the company of friends who don't keep the precepts, or who might not only not keep precepts but might encourage you not to keep the precepts. And if you go into certain situations, social situations, even if it's family gatherings or parties or whatever, it can often become difficult to say no. Say no to alcohol, for example, or to drugs, or to be in a situation where there is exaggeration or not quite being open with the truth. And so it's a support for being able to keep the precepts to become more wise about where one goes and whom one associates with. This is actually something which becomes obvious, and one of the difficulties that people feel in the beginning of their training is they see that some friendships that they've had no longer serve, and that they have those friendships gradually start to wane and fall away. And this can be felt as something distressing, and it can also be a challenge how to get out of these friendships if you realise that they're no longer to one's advantage, no longer supporting one's spiritual aspirations. And so as we encounter these challenges, this is the place where we bring our practice to bear. And as we look at this gradual training, you will see that being able to fulfil all the different aspects of the training makes it easier and also obvious to be selective, and why it's necessary to be selective about the company one keeps and the places that one goes to. And seeing fear in the slightest fault. This is important to understand, because it can be misinterpreted to think that there's some external person or force that's judging one as bad or failing if one isn't living up to the standards that one's committed oneself to. And of course, if you're a monastic, there is an external standard in the vinaya, and certain behaviours which, if you commit those behaviours, you're no longer able to stay a monastic. So, for example, engaging in sexual intercourse for a monk or a nun is what is called a parajika, or defeat offence. And if you engage in sexual intercourse while you're a monastic, then you can no longer remain as a monastic. But generally speaking, when it says seeing fear in the slightest fault, it's because one starts to see the effect on one's mind of certain kinds of behaviour. One sees that if one engages in certain behaviour, if one associates with certain people, if one allows the precepts to slide in certain situations, that it creates an inner discomfort. And that inner discomfort can actually be very distressing, and it can undermine one's peace of mind, and it has an effect on the mind not only when one's engaging in that behaviour, but afterwards as well. And so knowing the effect of one's deliberate thought, speech and action on the mind, one starts to be very careful about keeping one's precepts and protecting one's mind from that. Once one allows even small defilements to enter the mind and one acts on them, then one sees that this is has very corrosive effect on the mind. And so one doesn't want to admit any kind of behaviour or quality into the mind that is going to undermine one's ability to follow this path. And so that is really the meaning of seeing fear in the slightest fault, not that an external force is going to judge you as not being up to scratch. So we train by undertaking the training precepts. And that doesn't mean just restraining one's behaviour, but it means when we see the benefit of restraint, we see the benefit of renunciation, that we actively cultivate the positive correlates of that behaviour. So if we see the benefit of speaking truthfully, honestly, we also start to refine our speech so that we try to only speak what is the truth and, for example, only speak about someone who is present, not to speak about people behind their back. That is a way in which we start to refine our speech, not just follow the precept in its bare black and white standing. So as we move on to verse 4, when Brahman, the bhikkhu, is virtuous and seeing fear in the slightest fault, trains by undertaking the training precepts, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, guard the doors of your sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint, guard the eye faculty, undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odour with the nose, on tasting a flavour with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the mind faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint, guard the mind faculty, and undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. So this guarding the doors of the senses is frequently mentioned as the next step on this gradual training. Remembering that in terms of the way that the mind works, it is contact through the sense doors which gives rise to feeling, which gives rise to craving, which gives rise to clinging, which sets in motion this chasing after desires, objects that we desire, or trying to avoid the things that we don't like. And that's what these states of, if the eye faculty is unguarded, even evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. Covetousness is wanting those things which we like and desire, and grief is trying to get away from or avoid those things which we don't like. And so it is a natural, spontaneous process that happens automatically when the sense bases come in contact with their respective objects. And the sense consciousness arises, that gives rise to contact, and then the mind is engaged with that object. And unless there is mindfulness established at that point, then the process of desiring or wanting to get away from and all the mental proliferation and the speech and behaviour that follows on from that just arises automatically. And so if we want to protect the mind, then we need to guard the doors of the sense faculties. And having just been away from the monastery and spent some time in Sydney and staying in a lay household and seeing just the sort of things that the mind is exposed to just in the course of the day through these sorts of media that come in through the newspapers, television, all those sorts of things, just going to the shopping centre, walking down the street. It's amazing just what is what the mind comes in contact with, even just doing something as simple as going for a walk. Now, just reflect that here is the Buddha 2,500 years ago in a much less intensive situation, making as the second step of the gradual training, guarding the sense faculties. And one can assume that in the time of the Buddha, there wasn't television and media coming into the household. There wasn't advertising blaring on the buses and in the shopping centre. There wasn't all of the things that used to be done in the privacy of one's own home out on the street or out on the beach for you to see. It was a much more gentle environment, one would assume, in the time of the Buddha than it is today. And yet here he is making so important guarding the sense faculties. So what to say of today? If we want to protect the mind, if we want to be able to keep on moving the mind in the direction of peace and stillness, then we have to protect it in the non-meditation time. When we sit down to meditate and we turn the attention inwards, then we're guarding the senses. But our meditation time relative to the rest of our day is a very small time span. And so if we want to protect the mind and give it the most help for being able to attain peace and stillness in meditation, then we have to protect it when we're out of meditation. And I know that it's impossible to protect it completely, but we do have to become to exercise discretion over what we allow the mind to be exposed to. Just in terms of the intensity and the continuity of the stimulation that's available just in the radio and television, just the constant noise, just the speed with which things are done, all of that speeds up the mind. It provides the mind with countless images that it has to process. And when we sit down to meditate, very often that's what it does. It just processes those images that it's been exposed to. So it's really important to understand the importance of guarding the senses. And one of the other factors of guarding the senses is to exercise not only restraint, but right effort. When one is exposed to objects which incite desire or exposed to objects which give rise to aversion, to be mindful enough to notice the effect and to not indulge in proliferation, what's called papancha, the mental proliferation around these objects. Right effort means that we recognise when unwholesome states arise because of contact, when they're triggered within us, and that we don't indulge them. And unwholesome states don't necessarily arise just because it's an unpleasant object. We can see something in the catalogue that we really would like to have, and we're encouraged to go and get it because it's on special and it's 30% off, and we didn't really think that we needed it until we saw it in the catalogue, but gee, it's so cheap and we really miss a bargain if we don't go and get it now. And then we think, well, how can I get down there while the sale is on, because I've got other things to do, and now I can, if I call them, maybe I'll, this is the way a pleasant object gives rise to unwholesome states. So it's not just when it's an unpleasant object that we have to exercise right effort. Unwholesome states can arise even with a pleasant object. And then we see what does the mind, and at that point we have to be skillful at not indulging in proliferation, substituting, replacing that unwholesome state of mind with something more wholesome. And that's why it's very important and very helpful to cultivate mindfulness of bodily movements and activities, so that if we have nothing else to replace that thought with, that we can give full attention to our physical activities and allow the mind to take that up as the object that it pays attention to. So the next verse 5, when Brahman the bhikkhu guards the doors of his sense faculties, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come bhikkhu, be moderate in eating. Reflecting wisely, you should take food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting the holy life, considering, thus I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. And this verse is the verse that, as monastics, we say this reflection every day before we eat, that we're not eating for amusement or intoxication for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of this body, so that we can continue our spiritual practices. Now, food plays a very prominent part in all our lives, and it is essential for our continued existence. So it's not something that we can renounce, but we have to recognise the hold that it can have over our mind. Just in the way that mental proliferation can arise through any of the sense doors because of objects that we come in contact with, lots of mental proliferation arises around food. And so one of some of the mental obsessions which the Buddha has nominated as things which take over our thinking and, if you like, gobble up our mind moment after moment because we get obsessed in thinking about them, are thoughts about our own body, thoughts about the body of other people, and thoughts about food. And you can see how these are all connected, because very often we are obsessed with food because we think that by eating the right food, we're going to keep this body healthy. We're going to make it well, and it's never going to get sick. We're going to stop the aging process. We're going to be able to be forever youthful, forever fit. Or we look at the body of someone else and we think, wow, I'd like to look like that person. And so we start to obsess about how we're going to make our body look like their body. And very often that includes thinking about, I wonder what they eat, or that's how they get to be so healthy or so strong, so I'm going to eat the same things, or I'm going to eat in the way that they eat, or I'm going to follow what they're doing. And so all of these things are actually mentioned in this reflection. Taking food for amusement or for intoxication for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness. These things to do with our own body and with the body of others. And centering around food. So when we talk about moderation in eating, it's not just the quantity of food that we eat. It's not just the times during the day that we eat. It's all of our relationship to food and how much food we actually need and what kind of food suits our body and what sort of why we're eating the food in the first place. Again, when we start to train in this way, just like the young colt, we may writhe and contort and try to wriggle out of this way of approaching our food or approaching our body, because it's not what we're used to and we don't like it. We like to have at least one area of our life where we can do things the way we like and follow our own preferences. But even in this area of food, the Buddha is saying, this is part of your spiritual practice. And actually, as we take note of these training rules, as we try to implement the guarding of the senses, as we try to moderate our eating, this is a way we move from virtue becoming just something which is external in our external behaviour and our relationship to the objects and people of this world, to something that we start to internalise. It becomes a part of our normal way of being, and this has an effect on the mind. And this is how the practice of virtue, the cultivation of virtue, starts to seamlessly move into the area of meditation. Because the mind that's developing in meditation needs the support that virtue provides. And once we provide that support, we are removing so many of the hindrances, the obstacles, the frictions from the mind which make it difficult for the mind to become concentrated. So these things, while they are advantageous in themselves, they lead to a much more easeful frame of mind, they are also indispensable supports for the development of the mind in meditation. So the next verse, verse 6, when Brahman the bhikkhu is moderate in eating, then as targeted disciplines him further, come bhikkhu, be devoted to wakefulness. During the day while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, you should lie down on the right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in your mind the time for rising. And this is the way that the Buddha went to sleep on the lion's pose. After rising in the third watch of the night while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. So in this devoted to wakefulness, which the Buddha is outlining, is sleep is restricted to 4 hours in the night. Now, that for most people is not possible. And so, again, we try to take this not as our absolute standard, but as something that we can use for reflecting on and asking ourselves the question, how much sleep do I really need? And particularly in this day and age where there seems to be no difference between day and night, there's 24 hours a day, things are going on. When I was staying in Sydney, the place where I was staying is a holiday area, and some of the hotels stay open all night. Even the supermarket stays open all night. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, people are walking back and forth, going home or going shopping as though it's the afternoon. And it's very interesting in that situation, people conducting themselves with very little thoughtfulness for the people who are in bed asleep or trying to be asleep and who are getting up in the morning and going to work in the normal office hours. And so you can see that this idea of the 24-hour clock, it's fraught with difficulties because not everyone is following the same timetable. These are interesting things just to reflect on, to see the consequences of them. Now, if we're trying to cultivate a spiritual life, we do need to give ourselves enough time to sleep so that the mind and the body are refreshed. And if we're staying up into the early hours of the morning playing on the computer, because computer games on this side of the world coincide with computer games on the other side of the world, but it's 2 o'clock in the morning in Australia. If we're spending our time doing those things, then it makes it very difficult for the mind to be fresh for our meditation. There are all sorts of things that we can get involved in these days which take up our time and our energy and which are quite looked on as quite normal, quite okay for anyone who's wants to do them. But if we want to pursue this spiritual path, we have to give priority to those things which are part and parcel of the spiritual training. And so it means making decisions about what we spend our time doing and making sure that we get enough rest so that when we do have the chance to get up early in the morning to meditate, that we're able to do that because our mind is refreshed and ready for it. The other aspect of wakefulness is just trying to bring a brightness and attention to what we're doing throughout the course of the day. Rather than thinking that our spiritual practice only takes place in formal meditation, we understand that there are many opportunities during the day to see the connections between what is happening, what we would say is the mundane world or the mundane life, and actually aspects of Dharma. And so that sort of attitude of wakefulness is to keep the eye open for the way in which Dharma presents itself in the ordinary daily life. So yesterday in the flower puja, I was talking about how we have the opportunity to reflect that the flowers which we offer, though they're beautiful now when we offer them, they fade and vanish very quickly and become smelly and we want to throw them away. But we don't just say that and then forget about it till the next time we do a flower puja. When we walk in the garden and we notice how entranced we are with the beautiful flowers, or we may get into a comparison with the next door neighbour's flowers compared to ours, and we notice how the proliferation around that can arise. This is an opportunity to bring together all of this that we're talking about, the gradual training. Seeing that flower gives rise to mental proliferation with craving and clinging. I want that flower, I like this flower. I don't like the fact that they fade and vanish. We can watch all of those things only if we're awake, if we're mindful, but we can see the Dharma in our everyday life. And this is when the training really starts to take off, when it's not just limited to those special times or special places that we think of as our training. So verse 7, when Brahman, the bhikkhu, is devoted to wakefulness, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Act in full awareness when flexing and extending the limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl. Act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. So this is a standard description of mindfulness with clear comprehension. So paying attention in our daily life, even to the most mundane activities. And when Brahman, the bhikkhu, possesses mindfulness and full awareness, then the Satthagata disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. So resorting to a secluded resting place can just be doing our meditation each day, but it can also mean taking time to go on meditation retreats. Getting right away from our household duties and the familiar environment of the household and going into an environment that is set up to support the seclusion of the mind from its usual preoccupations. So again, when we're looking at this gradual training, we're not just thinking of for monastics, but for anyone who's taking up this spiritual life. And seeing that before one gets even to the meditation, there are all these things which are not just preliminaries, they conduce to supporting the mind to move into meditation. He resorts to a secluded resting place. On turning from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. Percipient of light, mindful and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. Now these are the five hindrances. The hindrances which are imperfections of mind and weakened wisdom. These are the Buddha's words. But you can see how all of the other things which we've been talking about help the practitioner work with these hindrances in the meditation. Just keeping the precepts means that one is constantly challenging one's sensual desire, one's ill will. It doesn't give free rein to those things anymore. And by guarding the senses and by practicing right effort, one becomes aware of what feeds those hot, unwholesome states and what actually leads to peacefulness. So one is not only challenging one's desire, one is practicing letting go of desire. So one abandons covetousness. One is not only practicing not acting on one's ill will, one is practicing developing compassion. So that when one sits down to meditate, one not only has already helped the mind dealing with these states, but one also starts to understand the process by which these states of mind arise and understands what feeds them, what supports them, and what challenges them, cuts them out, allows them to cease. So So it's impossible to work with the hindrances just in the meditation alone. If one doesn't support the mind in the rest of one's life, then one spends the whole of the meditation practice, each session, just processing the defilements, just coming up again and again against sensual desire, ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And doubt, which is very undermining of all of the work that we do, we start to challenge doubt by seeing for ourselves in our daily life this path of practice works. There are benefits to be gained long before we attain any deep states of meditation. So we have proof which we don't need to be convinced about by others. We have it through our direct experience. So in the next verse 10, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. First of all, accompanied by applied and sustained thought, that doesn't mean thought as in thinking, it means applying one's mind to the meditation object and sustaining one's attention on the meditation object. And the first jhana arises as a result of being secluded from sensual desire, secluded from unwholesome states of mind. Before one attains the first jhana, one is working at applying one's mind to the meditation object and sustaining one's attention on the object. And as I was mentioning in the talk on Friday night and at the meditation class yesterday, what we're trying to do is to close the gap between the observer and the object that's being observed. That is, to gradually bring the attention right onto the target being the object. In this case, we say, for example, the breath, that the attention is focused exclusively on the breath. We close the gap, that is, the attention is so close to the object that nothing comes between. Now, what normally comes between is thinking, thoughts about this, thoughts about that. And that thinking process is fed by the five hindrances. And those five hindrances are the expression of the ego, the sense of self. And so, in order to close the gap, we have to gradually undermine that sense of self which is fed by the five hindrances. And that's what we do again and again in our daily life by keeping the five precepts, by challenging our self-centeredness, by challenging our likes and dislikes, which are expressions of our ego. What comes between us and the meditation object, or comes between the observer and the meditation object, is all of the things that supports the sense of self. So, again, if we only try to do that during the meditation, we will be depending on willpower to try and force the mind onto the meditation object and to squeeze out anything else that comes in. And that willpower will just be an expression of our ego, just an expression of our sense of self. So it's really essential that we do the work in our daily life refraining from feeding the hindrances, refraining from feeding what is an expression of the sense self. The hindrances are imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. And they weaken wisdom because when they are present, we view everything that's happening through the prism of self. We're not seeing it devoid of me in the middle. And that's why we don't see clearly. The hindrances weaken wisdom. So in order to see things without the addition of me, without the addition of our ego, filtering things, interpreting things, misinterpreting things, there has to be this direct relationship with the meditation object. The gap between the observer and the observed has to be closed. And so we work on gradually closing that gap throughout the course of our day by following all of these guidelines, and we produce a mind which is then able to come to the meditation object and without any distraction, focus exclusively on the meditation object. And this is the produces the first jhana accompanied by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, that is, applying the mind to the meditation object and keeping it there, he enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So once one has closed that gap between the observer and the objects being observed and is secluded, one is then able to attain that state with greater ease, without the five hindrances getting in between. And as one is able to accomplish this turning away from the external world and turning away from this self-centeredness, it produces a feeling of deep inner ease and self-confidence, because one has a source for one's happiness and well-being which is no longer dependent on external conditions. So that rapture and pleasure is born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, he abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware. Still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, he enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Now, these states which are attained in meditation have a lasting effect on the body and the mind once one comes out of the meditation. There's a deep sense of ease in the physical body, and the mind becomes very lucid, very peaceful, and very strong, strongly able to focus and to also remain undistracted by the external environment. The pull and push of the external environment is much reduced even after one has come out of the meditation. So there's this carryover effect. And as one is able to experience this again and again, one is able to abide in this pleasant state out of meditation. And this becomes one's way of finding peace in the world. And one can imagine that if one is able to find this peace internally, and that continues, becomes one's habitual way of being, that one's desires or one's concerns with the world are greatly reduced. And so there's a cumulative effect while one is practicing this, these states of mind, that provides a pleasant abiding here and now, and is also conducive to the arising of wisdom. Because even when one is out of the meditation, the sense of self, the ego, is greatly diminished, and one can see things in a new way, in a clear way, which is different from the usual filtering of things through the self-centered view. So the Buddha goes on to say, "This is my instruction, Brahman, to those bhikkhus who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet attained the goal, who abide aspiring to the supreme security from bondage. But these things conduce both to a pleasant abiding here and now, and to mindfulness and full awareness for those bhikkhus who are arahants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge." So the Buddha is saying that those in higher training are those who have already accomplished at least the first stage on the path to enlightenment. And while they continue to train, this is how they should train. And it's interesting to see that it's not that you get to the first stage on the path and then you are given the training you should do next. It's the same training at a deeper and deeper level. The same things have to be accomplished. They have to be accomplished again and again and again. And even those who are already enlightened, they practice these things, particularly the meditative absorptions, so that they have a pleasant abiding here and now. When this was said, the Brahman Danika Moggallana asked the Blessed One, "When Master Gotama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, do they all attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, or do some not attain it?" This is a question we all want to know. Will we, is it guaranteed that we'll get to the end? And it's interesting that in other places in the suttas, the Buddha doesn't answered this sort of question, but here he gives an answer which we're all capable of understanding. "When Brahman, they are thus advised and instructed by me, some of my disciples attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some of them do not attain it. Master Gotama, since Nibbana exists and the path leading to Nibbana exists, and Master Gotama is present as the guide, what is the cause and reason why, when Master Gotama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it? As to that, Brahman, I will ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Brahman? Are you familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha?" That was the other town that was the second strongest, biggest town in India at the time of the Buddha, which was several hundred miles away from Savatthi. "Yes, Master Gotama, I'm familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha." "What do you think, Brahman? Suppose a man who wanted to go to Rajagaha and he approached you and said, 'Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. Show me the way to Rajagaha.' Then you told him, 'Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while and you will see a certain village. Go a little further and you will see a certain town. Go a little further and you will see Rajagaha with its lovely parks, groves, meadows and ponds.' Then, having thus advised and instructed by you, he would take a wrong road and would not go to the west. Then a second man came who wanted to go to Rajagaha, and he approached you and said, Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. Then you told him, Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while, and you will see Rajagaha with its lovely parks, groves, meadows, and ponds. Then, having been thus advised and instructed by you, he would arrive safely in Rajagaha. Now, Brahman, since Rajagaha exists, and the path leading to Rajagaha exists, and you are present as the guide, what is the cause and reason why, when those men have been thus advised and instructed by you, one man takes the wrong road and goes to the west, and one arrives safely in Rajagaha? What can I do about that, Master Gotama? I'm the one who shows the way. So too, Brahman, Nibbana exists, and the path leading to Nibbana exists, and I am present as the guide. Yet when my disciples have been thus advised and instructed by me, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some of them do not attain it. What can I do about that, Brahman? The Tathagata is the one who shows the way. When this was said, the Brahman Ganika Moggallana said to the Blessed One, There are persons who are faithless and have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, who are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, unguarded in their sense faculties, immoderate in eating, undevoted to wakefulness, unconcerned with recluseship, not greatly respectful of training, luxurious, careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, lazy, wanting in energy, unmindful, not fully aware, unconcentrated, with straying minds, devoid of wisdom, drivellers. Master Gotama does not dwell together with these. Interesting that in another sutta the Buddha describes some of the disciples who've gone forth in these terms too. And we can see that even in the time of the Buddha, there were people who had the opportunity to live the homeless life, but who neglected their training. So it's wasn't unusual then, and so we can't be surprised if it happens from time to time now. But the Brahman goes on, But there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued and loose-spoken, who are guarded in their sense faculties, moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, concerned with the recluseship, greatly respectful of training, not luxurious or careless, who are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated with unified minds, possessing wisdom, not drivellers. Master Gotama dwells together with these. Just as black orris root is reckoned as the best of root perfumes, and red sandalwood is reckoned as the best of wood perfumes, and jasmine is reckoned as the best of flower perfumes, so too Master Gotama's advice is supreme among the teachings of today. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overturned, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. This is one of the stock phrases describing the Buddha as revealing what was hidden and showing the way to one who was lost. All of those things is a standard phrase, and then the taking of refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as a lay follower, that is also a stock passage which appears in many other suttas. So that's the end of the sutta, and analogy of the journey on the spiritual path and the role of the teacher as being only the shower of the way. This is one of the most famous teachings given by the Buddha to encourage all of us to think that it's not enough to know about the destination and not enough to have the instructions, that we actually have to walk the journey ourselves and walk all the way until we get to the destination. So knowing the way to Rajagaha is not enough. We have to actually make the journey. So that's the end of the teaching. Does anyone have any questions? So the question. Yes. So. Yes. So the question is, if someone has taken up the training and they're not training properly, and they won't attain Nibbana, does that mean just in this lifetime? Yes, it does, because depending on what new causes and conditions they put into play, that will be the result will be their progress or their lack of progress on the path. So, in the sense that we say, well, the result of attaining Nibbana happens according to causes and conditions. It's also that it doesn't matter what sidetracks we take. If we get eventually back onto the main path by practicing correctly, then Nibbana isn't unavailable to anyone. So it may be unavailable in this lifetime itself. And it's said that if anyone commits any of the five heinous crimes, such as killing one's mother or father, or wounding a Buddha, or killing an arahat, or creating a schism in the Sangha, that for that this lifetime itself, it's impossible to attain even a stage on the path. But and that one's rebirth at the end of this birth will be in the hell realms. But that doesn't mean that one can't, in the future, after that karma is exhausted, come back and practice again and attain Nibbana. So it's all according to causes and conditions. But I can't stress enough how important it is that we start to get serious with these other aspects of the gradual training, the ones that are outlined here, if we want our meditation practice to bear fruit. So gradual training and a gradual practice and then a gradual progress. So if there are no more questions, we'll just conclude by chanting the sharing of merits. And those of you who are familiar with the chanting of merits, please chant along. And for those who aren't, when I say, may the merits made by me, that you refer that to yourself and mentally share the merits along with us. May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable, by rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me. May beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you for coming.